look like you know what you're doing.
So another another person I found here walking around at lunch at In Situ today is Grand Design star Tessa Kingsbury. Tessa, how have you enjoyed the morning so far?
Oh, I've loved it, Arch.
Yeah?
I feel like these are my people. It's you know, galing around with so many people that are of my village.
Yes, yes, your whānau. You're in the obligatory all-black outfit.
It was an accident, Your Honour.
It's an accident. I see. What did you make of Junya Ishigami and Barclay and Krauss?
I love Junya. I just think there is so much diversity in what he presented today. I am obsessed with the cave that wasn't a cave that was poured and then dug out. And
you dig a hole in the ground and fill it with concrete.
I wish we could ask that man 1,000 questions. Yeah. I should go and hunt him down.
Yeah, I'm sure that would go fine. thanks very much, Tess. Kia ora and welcome to 76 More Rooms, a podcast about architecture from Aotearoa, New Zealand. This is episode 51, the third in our series, and we're here today at the NZIA Te Kahui Whaihanga In Situ 2024 biennial conference. And this is our third chat today, and we're talking with Jeannie Gang of Studio Gang. Thanks so much for your talk. They're always fantastic. I remember we chatted about someone describing coming to this conference today and seeing the international work as leaving you feeling a mix of inspired and depressed. The projects are just so exciting and so fascinating. So really loved your talk, and we're looking forward to chatting today. I wonder if, Jeannie, you could begin by just introducing yourself, telling us a bit about yourself and your work.
Yeah, I'm Jeannie Gang, and I started Studio Gang, in 97 or 98. And so it's a practice that started in Chicago and kind of grew to, we're now about 150 people and based in four different cities. So we're kind of local and global at the same time: Chicago, New York, San Francisco, and Paris.
You work across this amazing variety of scales, from the riverside boathouses you showed to, you know, 100-story towers such as the St. Regis. And I wanted to ask you what you thought the common thread was that ran through those projects.
Yeah, some people say that the projects don't look anything alike, but of course, you know, when you have something very small and something very big and different programs, they have different needs. So I think we always try to respond to the specifics of the project. So hopefully they will be more relevant to the users. But at the same time, there's, of course, a sensibility, I would say, or a direction that the design takes, with a real interest in making the materials express what they can do best. So if it's concrete, you know, it's easier to make it fluid and make it curve, for example. Wood can be good in tension, you know, and brick masonry, how can it be used to make a curve well, because it's a small element. So it's kind of like exploiting the material for what it can do the best. So you see that in the work. There's always an attention to the way people see each other inside. So inside or outside, creating eye contact, creating vistas for people that are oblique and not axial, I think. That's another thing that is really exciting to us, because it allows people to engage with each other if they can see each other. And some people have called the work organic, but that's such a vague, it's a big word, but I would take it as a compliment. If you can make architecture be more organic, that would be a direction I would love to be able to claim.
And as your firm has grown, and we've talked about the common thread that runs through those projects, how do you like to work to ensure that this philosophy or the step, which comes from you originally, remains intact throughout those? Are you personally on everything that's coming from your studio, or do you delegate a lot of that?
Well, now with the size that we are, I definitely still work on each project, but some more than others. And also we have a lot of different types of clients, so that some clients like require more, you know, interaction. Some are more groups that make decisions in certain ways. So we try to tailor our practice to work well and efficiently with each kind of client. And I'd say that, going back to your earlier part of your question, what we try to keep the same is the methodology of design. So starting out each project with research, pretty deep research, and then also trying to connect to people from there in some way, and to get a response, even if it's not the end user of the building, maybe it's someone who just lives there, and see what's going on in the place. And that matters to me, because it gives you tangent ideas that might not be important, but they might be important. So it's kind of a broad net, like, to spread out in the beginning, and then things rise to the top of, in terms of what's going to be relevant.
Hmm. That's really interesting. I was also struck watching a presentation where we often talk here, and I think possibly in architectural circles in general, about architecture being pushed to the margins as a kind of service provider. Mm-hmm. But you made, I think, in the range of projects you showed, a really good argument for architecture being fundamental, mm-hmm. And being at the centre of city and community shaping. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that intent that seems to sit within your practice.
Yeah, no, that's really so interesting, because I think sometimes we architects, we make too big a claims, you know, because we can't do everything. There's a lot of forces that are at play in terms of what gets built. But what we try to do is to keep some sovereignty, I guess, we work with clients, but we also do projects that we just want to do with no client, and that could be a research project. And, you know, weirdly, sometimes it turns into a project with a client, but then you have your established position and your agenda that is, you know, not just a formal agenda, it's an agenda for what is needed, you know, for the place. And then you can go in more empowered than if you go into a project where you are receiving a brief and are, you know, it's a very different position to be in. So I would recommend that for anyone to try, you know, just to think about what kind of project you want to do. It can be your imagination. It can be something you think is needed, and you can do that project. No one's saying you can't, right? So it's a great way to keep some power in your hands, and then it ends up becoming very valuable if you have knowledge of something more than what the person coming to you with project has. You can bring that to the project.
You've also talked about architecture as being something that can accelerate the search for climate change mitigation, but also for equity, social mm-hmm. equity. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you could talk about how that factors into your practice mm-hmm. and about the projects that you choose to take on.
Yeah, we have started, you know, we never learned in architecture school, like, how to engage with the public and to get them into this design, to co-authorship. And so that's something that had to come after school in a certain way. And I learned from others that were doing that, and we've even had people come teach us, like, how do you ask the right question to, you know, someone that doesn't know much about architecture? So I think that engagement, that process is really, I'm excited about that, and it's empowering. The process is the justice. I mean, by letting people into the process, you are giving them a voice, and they are getting a chance to be heard. And, you know, sometimes it's things that don't really apply directly to design, but many times it can be, and you just have to be open to hearing what people have to say.
That you touch on something interesting there about that particular skill not being in school,
yeah.
And there's a whole range of others. Do you think that's a fundamental? Do you teach?
I do.
Do you think that's a fundamental thing that's missing or it's okay for it to come later? Because I mean, there's a theme, and particularly say with Kai's work as well, and your work, that Riverside work, where the beginning was about simply, you know, you create access to the water so that you create champions and stewards, which creates the groundswell to do the next thing.
Yes.
And then the next thing. That is such a broader type of thought, both in its scope and its time scale, than the traditional architectural project would think of. And, you know, I think that's incredibly powerful. Do you think it should be more part of our earlier education?
Yeah, I mean, that is... I mean, I have to be honest, with my teaching, I've been working on like reuse and those kinds of things, and oftentimes give a brief to students, but sometimes I don't give them the program. So that is where they can start to use those skills to research what could work there. So you're thinking more like not a receiver of like from a client and just like, here, do this. It's more like instigating the project. So in that way, I think we can start to help students think that way. But I think I like your idea of like you could even stretch that out further and have a project which is like, you know, what are the 5-year, 10-year, and 15-year milestones in your thinking for this project? That would really start people thinking differently. I think landscape architects probably think that way more.
Maybe. It's got such a strong temporal element that it evolves over time. I mean, we've got the time it takes to build, but largely once it's built, it's built.
Right.
What's the skill you have and use now that is the most unexpected one compared to when you first started being an architect?
Good question. Diplomacy? I don't know.
Is it a non-design skill?
Yeah, you know? I think I would say that it is non-design skill. But there is something also that, like, when you first start, or when I first started, there's not as much confidence that you know where something is going in the right direction. So it's a little bit scarier. But like now I can see a project, it might have awkward times, or you know, you know it can make its way out of there. And
Is that intuition?
It's kind of just experience based. Yeah. And you know when it's in trouble too.
Yeah.
So you just have better, it's just more experience that allows you to help guide work of others as well as, you know, your own thinking, but you still have to be open to opportunities and surprises that you know, every person in the office could have a great idea. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times it is also about, like, you might think you know the answer but don't say it and let the teams struggle a little bit and try to have solutions, because that's a way of building your team and their confidence. That's, I guess I'm getting mature.
I'm trying to work out if it's something that can be taught. It doesn't sound it can.
I was going to say, is that, you know, you've described a way of encouraging students to think beyond, or to think openly about the potential of the project. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether there's that stakeholder management and that navigating a project, not just through a design process, but through the process of the project coming about, which is such a bigger thing. I wonder if that's just something that does come with a bit of time and experience.
Yeah, and I love that architects can have this skill and use it. What I see now is that skill is becoming now another consultant. And so I worry that, like, we'll lose that again as that becomes, you know, a community engagement consultant. And then once again, we're not doing it. So I always fear that loss of our, the things that we do, our profession, we always give them away. And then we narrow ourselves down, and that's when you become less relevant, I think.
One of the projects of yours that has been, I don't know if you call it completed recently, but Tom Lee Park in Memphis. I really enjoyed reading about that in architectural record earlier. Yeah. And that seems like it incorporates a lot of the things you've been talking about. It was collaborative because you were working with a landscape architecture firm. Could you talk a little bit about what that project is and what the process of realizing it to this point has been?
Oh, yes. Oh, I could talk about that for a long time. It was a project that took a long time. We started out, the city of Memphis asked us to look at their whole waterfront because the Mississippi River, you know, was always like their transportation corridor and not really a front. It was like a back to the city. They wanted to turn that around. And so our first step was really working with a lot of different stakeholders just to understand the scope of this very long waterfront and the different characters that it would have. And then the parks asked us to focus in on one project, Tom Lee Park, which is it's a former dike, or it still is a dike, but it's just a big flat area to prevent flooding. But it was called a park named after Tom Lee, who's this kind of this local hero that saved 32 people from drowning. He's a black man, a river worker, and he couldn't swim himself. He went out in his boat and pulled people in one by one. So he's like an incredible figure. But there wasn't anything in this park except for kind of like just a big flat space for concerts and more privately held leases on the park. So we went about an engagement process to, like, what would people want to do there? Instead of saying, here's what it could be, we went and worked with a lot of different groups, and one was a youth design leadership group, a group of high school students that we kind of engaged as a team member, so they got to experience this, like, what is design feel like? And they just brought up things they wanted to do that were everyday things, like basketball, play, you know, have a place to go get a coffee or something to drink, a bathroom, playground. I mean, these kind of everyday things. And we realized they're right. It's like, that's exactly what's missing out of this park. And so we had to also maintain the open space for these concerts. And then we clustered these activities in different zones. And really just thought about how could you elevate those and make them, like, if you're going to play a basketball game, it's like on display. It's almost like a theater, and you have the Mississippi River as a backdrop. So that's kind of how we went about it. And as we were in the design, the people that had the lease for the concerts sued the city to stop the project because they didn't want, you know, other people using their park, which is a public park. So it took a while. We went through arbitration, showing how their concerts could still work there and all those things. It was a very long, drawn-out thing. But ultimately, it got solved. We got it built, and it opened. And then everybody was, like, ecstatic about this place. So it's, like, happy ending. No one... It turns out no one was against this park. They don't, like, they don't admit to it now. They were all, like, supporting the park. So so now it's
except,
like...
Except for the lawsuit.
Yeah. Right, except for that. But no, but it was a great outcome. It just took patience, and I was so glad to have that engagement because there were so many supporters, true supporters, that were... Their voices had been heard, and they were able to take part in this design process.
And is that leading, as you've argued, to iterations that will mean other parts of the riverfront are also redeveloped?
Yes, the long game there is, you know, piece by piece turning back toward the riverfront, which is, it's such a nice activation element for it. I mean, the river is huge, the Mississippi River, and then it's got so much activity on it, and even it's a working waterfront, barge traffic thing, so it really kind of has a nice activation to it. So there'll be other parts to it coming online.
You mentioned patience, taking a long-term view. You know, how do you do that? How do you hold on? The Gilder Museum, I think you said, was a 10-year project.
Yes.
It's a very long time to kind of keep the faith.
Well, they were... that particular project, even though it took 10 years, and that also had to do with a lot of processes and getting sued also by others that slowed it down. But it was never a doubt that was going to happen. That was you know, for sure, and just a very strong client group and committed, and a project that was so needed. And so I didn't ever think that it wouldn't happen. But what's weird for me for that project is to have conceived it when we did, which was a long time ago. And as you know, in the beginning, like, how would we ever build this? And then really it took time to locate the techniques and the software and the, you know, all the things that
this
came together.
This is primarily the atrium.
Yes, that is which is the structure.
Yep.
And it took time to, you know, get it on the budget. And so, you know, it just step by step went through. A lot of things are like that. Just, you know, just to keep patience, it's like you need to make little progress all the time. Keep it moving. Don't put it away. And just but I also think another thing is looking toward the end of the goal. So that's what we were talking about before, like if you can look 10 years out at what you want the city to be, and then you can see your progress as steps toward that. So have that goal in mind.
Oh, I love that.
It's a skill that you know, community stakeholder consultants don't have, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that atrium space, you know, unbelievable. You talked about customized software and some of the. Can you talk a little bit just about technology in your method and in your practice? Because at the same time, you showed this fantastic slide of just a big block of ice. I don't know if you were carving or using
blowtorch.
A torch. You know, so the way that there's a relationship between a natural process of erosion or melting and then technology being able to turn it into something buildable.
I mean, well, as someone, I just like making things, so. I never want to let go of that physical making that you have in the studio, even though, you know, it's completely possible to do everything digitally. So, like, we keep a shop in the office so that we can play with materials, and you discover things that way, too. But you need both. You really need the tools to be able to edit, to be able to make precise geometry that is buildable, and to figure out how it could be buildable. You know, we need the technology so much. So I don't like to put it out as like the first thing about our practice, because there's more, you know, the practice is much more about the big ideas. But for sure, any tool that we can use that makes things easier, we will pick it up and try it out, you know, and that's without fetishizing it. That's the difference, I think. But it is amazing what you can do with some of the tools these days. Like right now, I'm really interested in flow studies of just how you can use those elements to understand movement of people in random areas, and we're working on an airport right now, so those are kind of like really
like
interesting.
Pedestrian flow analysis,
yes,
that sort of thing.
Yeah, and throughput in like with all of the steps in an arrival and or departure sequence. And
it's interesting that that experiential component was something we just talked to Barclay and Krauss about, and I think what I realised in retrospect is we were talking to them about, or I was asking them about what it's like as an individual, whereas you have this slide about individuals, like making eye contact, the two little
lovers. Yeah,
you know, and that's and also just a really important part of the experiential aspect, even just from a point of view of, say, wayfinding and flow.
Yeah.
You look where you want to go and you intuit signals that tell you that what you need is that way. Is that part of that process, particularly in those public buildings?
Yes, of course, working with experts in those areas, but that really needs to be integrated into the architecture. You know, a lot of times when we look at renderings, you know, it's like they're straight on views, but our heads move and we see different things, and that's what activates the space. So when you unstack things, it starts getting interesting. Or, you know, so pathways or balconies or whatever it is, you know, thinking about how you make eye contact with others is is really important, I think, for making a space social.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. If you look at all of the vernacular meeting houses, they're always oriented toward the center, or either around water or fire or light or something like that, because people want eye contact. I mean, that's really a good thing to, it's a good lens to use for designing interior space.
Jenny Gang, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope that the talks are up on YouTube at some point and people can see the work that's incredibly expensive and hits on so many notes that so many other architects just make one part of their practice. So thank you very much for making time with us. Enjoy the rest of your time here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.